You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to today's reading for the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for March 5th, Tuesday. I'm Shelby Ryan from Drake University, and here is our first story. County Agency New Visions team up to provide hot showers for homeless population by David Golbitz. For people experiencing homelessness, one of the biggest barriers to acquiring housing and employment is hygiene. It's difficult to put forth an effort to fill out applications for jobs or assistance if you haven't showered for days or even weeks, let alone have the confidence to go in for a job interview. Through a partnership with Pottawamie County Public Health, New Visions Homeless Services has a new tool in its arsenal to help people experiencing homelessness feel refreshed and energized. A portable shower stall set up at the nonprofit organization's warming center at 1607 Avenue 1 in Council Bluffs. We are always trying to look at taking down barriers to serve the individuals that are in need, New Vision CEO Brandy Waller told the Nonpareil. So we have been able to operate the warming center for the last 4 years, but something that has been missing is showers. The warming center is exclusively for experiencing street-level homelessness, she said, and the ability to take a shower is huge for those seeking support from New Visions. When they're coming in and getting meals and getting connected, a lot of them haven't showered for days and sometimes weeks, Waller said. It's meeting the basic simple needs of hygiene, safety, and food. For public health officials, regardless of whether cleanliness is close to godliness, a shower definitely helps stave off infection and illnesses. People experiencing homelessness are more susceptible to what's called wash-related injuries. That stands for water, sanitation, and hygiene. Public health epidemiologist Candy Hayer said, if they do not have the proper hygiene or unclean water, they can be susceptible to things such as Shigella, hepatitis A, things that are mostly related to, like, fecal matter. Being unable to properly clean can lead to skin infections, lice, diarrhea, or other serious diseases, Hayer said. We knew that addressing this first, especially with lessons learned from COVID, it's not as simple as hand sanitizer for certain populations, Hayer said. Full body cleanliness, proper hygiene, that sometimes is not accessible. This is a multi-use, long-lasting, easily sustainable way to use that dollars that we don't often get, so we wanted to use it well. Among the funds Pottawamie County received from the federal government to help against COVID-19 were funds specifically set aside for infection prevention that didn't necessarily need to be used to fight the pandemic. Public health infection preventionist Jordan Ranta told the Nonpareil that the shower could help with a variety of issues. We just wanted it to be long-lasting, something that's maintainable and sustainable, Ranta said. So far, the new shower at the warming center has been so popular that New Visions had to get a new heating unit from the shop in Woodbine to ensure the water will be hot for whomever wants to use it. The showers are very popular here, so they go all day from when we're open from 9 a.m. till 4 p.m., and the heater wasn't able to heat the water fast enough, Waller said. Now they can continue to go all day, and we can meet the needs so nobody has to, you know, wait for a shower on Thursday when it's Tuesday. With the warming center scheduled to shut down for the season at the end of March, New Visions has come up with a way to bring showers to the homeless encampments around the city. New Visions has had a food truck donated by Food Bank of the Heartland. With a trailer attached to the truck, volunteers will be able to deliver not just meals, but hot showers as well. So when our food truck's out in the community, we will be able to take the showers on the trailer, meeting individuals where they're at, Waller said. New Visions has seen amazing success so far with its street outreach team. Last year, of all the people that we served, we had a 72% success rate of getting individuals off the streets and whether that into a shelter, housing. We actually had a couple that purchased a home, Waller said. They went from street-level homelessness to home ownership. And so this will be a beacon where people can come and get resources, and we could start that crucial conversation of what's the next step so that you're exiting homelessness and you're no longer on the streets. Going along with that article, our next article is titled, New Food Truck to Help New Visions Bring Meals to City's Homeless Populations. This was written by David Golbitz. When New Visions Homeless Services was founded in 1955, Harry Waller and sister Donna Campbell used an old school bus to drive around Council Bluffs to deliver peanut butter and jelly sandwiches to the city's homeless population. The delivery service gradually fell by the wayside after the organization moved into its first brick-and-mortar location and people began coming to them. Now, nearly 30 years later, New Visions is gearing up to take meals back out on the road again. But this time, instead of a school bus, they've got a new set of wheels. I saw this food truck at New Visions campus when we were down at Christmas time doing the turkeys for them, said Randy Smith, who has been a volunteer at New Visions for more than 20 years. I got to walk around it, didn't get inside of a look yet. I saw they had the food truck. I knew it'd be. Smith said Brandy Waller, CEO of New Visions, and asked her, I see the food truck sitting down there. What are you doing with it? You know, the need still exists because there's a lot of people down by the river or other encampment areas, Smith told the nonpareil in an interview. They can't walk a mile or 2 miles down to get a meal, I said. Why don't we look at taking meals back out to them like we did in the very beginning? Smith and his friend Larry Hyatt, I'm unsure if I pronounced that right, so I will spell the last name, H-I-A-T-T, have been volunteering their time and energy at New Visions Homeless Services for more than 2 decades, first cooking holiday turkeys for folks at the shelter, and then driving that old bus around to the various encampments. First started out, there were only 3 turkeys, Smith said. The last time we cooked, it was pre-COVID, we were doing 120 turkeys. So there's a huge need for it in town here. The New Visions food truck was donated by Food Bank of the Heartland, and the 2 Council Bluffs Rotary Clubs paid to have it painted with New Visions branding. The truck even has a name, Donna, stenciled along the front quarter panel. The first time we ever met Sister Campbell and Pastor Waller, it was down at the old Under the Viaduct location, Smith said. And there was just a huge need there, and we like volunteering, doing stuff. Waller said that New Visions needs about 1,500 volunteers per year to accomplish what her father-in-law set out to do back in 1955. If donating your time isn't an option, there are other ways to contribute too. Right now, I mean, there's a lot of needs because we're working with people that don't even have a bed, you know? And so I always say there's an opportunity for everybody to get involved, Waller said. The shelter goes through a lot of towels between its new mobile shower stall and its main campus, she said, and can always use more. We go through a lot of pillows, a lot of blankets, and then when individuals do leave, they get housed. They want to take the blankets and towels and pillows with them, and we want them to do that too. So we're always in need of that, Waller said. Another item that many people ask for, particularly in the winter, is coffee. Coffee is huge, Waller said. When I first came in, a lady was coming off the street. It was cold today, and she's like, oh, hot coffee. So we go through a lot of coffee here. We serve 2 meals a day, so always food, especially for the street-level population, like Pop Top, cans of ravioli and stuff like that, so that we could have it easily accessible to them so they have access to food. Financial donations are also always welcome, this year particularly, because New Visions doesn't have the necessary funding for its homelessness prevention program. That is my favorite program because it helps people from being homeless, Waller said. We pay for people's eviction notices to keep families in homes, people's first month's rent and deposit to get them out of homelessness. If we can prevent them from being homeless, that's a win for the community. Our next article is titled, Bluffs County Launches Pause for Paws Weekly Segment for Midlands Humane Society, written by Maria Garcia, Midlands Humane Society. Midlands Humane Society and Bluffs Country 106.5 are excited to roll out a brand new weekly morning show segment called Pause for Paws. While Bluffs Country has invited MHS to the station multiple times to let people know what's happening at the shelter, this new opportunity will provide a chance to showcase an adoptable animal each week. Midlands Humane Society is the first and only nonprofit humane society in Council Bluffs and serves both the city of Council Bluffs and Pottawamie County, and approximately 3,000 animals coming through the doors of the shelter each year. Getting the word out for the animals looking for a forever home is a big deal. While MHS has successfully utilized social media, news outlets, and newspaper ads, creating this partnership with Bluffs Country is an exciting new way to target potential adopters and people who resonate with the MHS mission. Bluffs Country is the first commercial station based in Council Bluffs since 1985, with Suite 98 moved on to Omaha. The station format is 90s and 2000s country. After hosting a fundraiser for Midlands Humane Society by collecting items for the animals in need, the host of the Council Bluffs Country Morning Show, Peggy Sweet, knew that it was possible to make an even bigger impact on the homeless animals in the community. Thus, Pause for Paws was born. Thank you to Baumgars. I'm unsure if I pronounced that correctly, so I will be spelling it. B as in boy, O-M-G-A-A-R-S, for sponsoring this segment each Friday morning. You can tune in to this weekly segment each Friday at 8:20 a.m. to learn more about the adoptable dogs, cats, and small critters at MHS, volunteering opportunities, and even upcoming events such as the MHS Gala. In addition to this weekly column in the Nonpareil, the radio segment is a great way to learn more about your local nonprofit humane society, and maybe even lead you to your next furry BFF. Tickets for the MHS Annual Gala are on sale now. You don't want to miss on our most pawsome fundraiser of the year that benefits the thousands of homeless animals that come to MHS each year. You can get your tickets at MidlandsHumaneSociety.org/adopt. I will spell that link out. MidlandsHumaneSociety.org/adopt. Our next article is titled Air Force Junior Reserve Officers Training Corps, JROTC, as the abbreviation, cadets, punch ticket to nationals with success at Kansas Drill Meet, written by Timothy Rower, spelled R-O-H-W-E-R. Give a salute to a group of local junior ROTC cadets for a job well done. At the recent 3rd Brigade Drill Meet in Leavenworth, Kansas, 18 cadets with the Council Bluffs Community School District's Air Force Junior Reserve Officer Training Corps, Unit Iowa 951, came home with big trophies from several events. Their accolades included 2 first-place finishes and 2 second-place performances. The local students competed against 12 other schools from Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas, and Missouri. They did much better than what they thought they would do. That's refreshing, said retired Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Bush, the unit's senior aerospace science instructor. The drill team cadets competed in 5 events in the novice division and earned 5 trophies. They finished in first place in unarmed exhibition drill, first place in novice division unarmed drill, second place in novice division overall, second place in unarmed regulation drill, third place in armed color guard, fifth place in unarmed color guard, and seventh place in armed regulation drill. Bush said regulation drills are scripted routines lasting about 6 minutes long, while exhibition drills are routines that students make up on their own and last 6 to 9 minutes. The armed and unarmed, no rifles, meaning color guard drills are scripted routines that last about 3 minutes. Since the start of this school year, the cadets have worked on these routines, including memorizing them, every school day from 6:30 to 7:30 a.m., Bush said. Through the Air Force JROTC program has been open to Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln High School students. This year's cadets are all from Abraham Lincoln, where the unit is based, Bush said. The Army JROTC at Leavenworth High School, where the meet was held on Saturday, February 24th, is the oldest in the country, Bush said. However, this was the first year in which that meet was used as a regional qualifier for JROTC programs for national-level drill meets. I used it as a guide for how we're doing, Bush said. They did quite well. Several of the local cadets will now compete in the Air Force Junior ROTC Open Drill Nationals in Dayton, Ohio on Saturday, March 16th, he said. They will compete between 20 and 25 schools all across the USA. The drill team cadets who performed at the Leavenworth meet were Corbin Brunel, Marcus Campbell, Kaylee Coffey, Lila Conant, Aiden Fairman, Joseph Hibbert, Alana Huggins, Aubrey Jarzinka, I'm unsure if I pronounced that right, so I will spell it, J-A-R-Z-Y-N-K-A, Haley Merritt, Hannah Merritt, Alex Meza, I'm unsure if I pronounced that right, so I will spell it, M-E-Z-A, Chris Beza, Morgan Miller, Cheyenne Rankin, Xander Rowland, Levi Van Riper, Alex Van Sickle, and Casey Wallers. Crystal Meza, mother of twins Alex and Chris, said she was one of the unit's loudest rooters in the stands. They were very excited when they won, she said. They rallied together and supported each other. Meza is vice president of the Iowa 951 Booster Club, which raises funds for the unit, such as traveling expenses, food, and supplies. We're very proud of them, she said. They all did a good job. Twins Haley and Hannah Merritt both said that they were excited on the unit's performance. It's great that all of our hard work paid off, Haley said. Hannah said the unit's unarmed team, numbering 14 cadets, will go to Ohio. Bush said important life skills for students can be gained by joining ROTC. Teamwork, leadership skills, and community service, he said. People interested in helping with travel expenses should make checks out to Iowa 951 in care of Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Bush and mail it to Abraham Lincoln High School. The address for the high school is 1205 Bonham Street in Council Bluffs, Iowa, zip code 51503. I wish all of the cadets a very good luck with their upcoming competition. Our next article is Iowa Primed for Potentially Epic Increase in Stream Pollution, written by Jared Strong from the Iowa Capital Dispatch. A buildup of nitrate in farm fields that has likely resulted from Iowa's longest-running drought in 70 years has set the stage for a potentially massive uptick in stream pollution, state water quality observers say. Research has shown that nitrogen fertilizer that goes unused by crops can be quickly flushed from those fields after a drought year, and Iowa's drought has been ongoing for more than three. The nitrate leach is often most pronounced during significant spring rains when fields have been fertilized but crops aren't growing yet. These extreme events are quickly becoming the rule, said Chris Jones, a former University of Iowa researcher who studies agriculture's effects on water quality. If and when we return to this wet regime, it's going to be epic. An example, in 2013, records spring rainfall lifted the state from one of its worst droughts. The result was more than a 400% increase in the amount of nitrate that was detected in Iowa streams from 2012 to 2013, according to data collected by the Iowa Nutrient Research Center. With stream flow data taken into account, 2013 was nearly the worst in two recent decades for nitrate pollution. The absolute amount of nitrate in streams statewide trended upward into 2016. Climate predictions show that the spring might be warmer and wetter than normal, state climatologist Justin Glizan, I'm unsure if I pronounced that right, so I will spell his last name, J-L-I-S-A-N, said. That increases the likelihood of thunderstorms and their heavier rainfalls, but he said it's impossible to say whether this spring will mimic 2013. Nitrogen is a key nutrient for Iowa corn to ensure maximum crop yields. It is often added to fields with synthetic fertilizers and livestock manure. But it poses environmental threats beyond the fields. Rivers are a significant source of drinking water for large cities, notably those in the Des Moines metro area. And nitrate must sometimes be removed from that water to make it safe to drink. Des Moines Water Works spent about $150,000 on nitrate removal in 2022. Further, elevated levels of nitrate and another prominent nutrient, phosphorus, can wreak havoc on aquatic ecosystems, leading to algae blooms that diminish oxygen in the water and release toxins that are harmful to swimmers. The crop fertilizers are leading contributors to the Gulf of Mexico's dead zone. The release of nitrate into Iowa streams is expedited by the state's expansive network of underground tiling. Those perforated pipes drain soggy fields to improve crop production, but also provide a quicker pathway for nitrate into streams. About half of the state's cropland is drained by tile, according to Iowa State University, and farmers continue to install more. A recently released survey by the U.S. Department of Agriculture showed a decrease in underground tiling in recent years, but it's unclear why. In drought years, the amount of nitrate and phosphorus in streams is expected to diminish. There's less water absorbing nitrate in the soil and less surface erosion, which causes phosphorus leaching. That is reflected by the state's stream monitoring data. There were decreases in nutrient loads in 2020 to 2021 and some of their lowest levels in two decades. Part of Iowa has been suffering from drought conditions since July 2020. About 79% of the state has some measure of drought now. But in 2022, the monitoring data, for which was recently published by the state, there was an increase in stream nitrate. That's despite 2022 having slightly less average rainfall statewide than 2021. Matt Helmers, who leads the Nutrient Research Center, attributes to jump to the buildup of nitrate during the drought and rains that fell in months where crops weren't growing. Just 3 months of 2022 had above normal rainfall, according to state weather data, March, November, and December. All of them fall outside of the state's traditional crop growing season. Commercial fertilizer sales have also reached a new record in Iowa in 2022, according to the Cedar Rapids Gazette, and farmers have been increasingly fertilizing their fields in the fall. That creates potential for additional stream pollution because the nutrients are in the soil for longer periods of time when crops aren't growing. State agriculture officials have sought with greater fervor in recent years to help farmers implement edge-of-field conservation practices. The projects are meant to slow the release of surface runoff and underground water flows to remove nutrients from them before they reach streams. The impact of that work on the state's overall water quality is not yet clear, Helmer said. The monitoring that folks are doing shows that these practices are effective. But we do need to recognize they're still treating a pretty small percent of the landscape, he said. Last year, Republican lawmakers cut a third of the research center's funding and moved it to the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship to help pay for the projects. The annual $500,000 amount matched what this research center had devoted to operate the Iowa Water Quality Information System, which aggregates real-time nitrate contamination data. Opponents of the move feared it might doom the system. Without data, it will be easy to say there's no problem, or we don't know how to measure the problem, Senator Janice Weiner, who's a Democrat from representing Iowa City, said last year. Instead, the research center cut its funding of the system by a third. There is still enough money to operate its network of 70 monitoring sites, said Larry Weber, director of IIHR, Hydroscience and Engineering at the University of Iowa, which operates the system. The monitoring sites are especially valuable because they provide continuously updating data about nitrate concentrations, Weber said, whereas other monitoring by the Department of Natural Resources happens once each month. Data from both sets of monitoring sites are used by the Nutrient Research Center to calculate annual nutrient loads. While the funding cut isn't expected to disrupt the UI monitoring network itself, it will impede the analysis of the data the network produces. It's easy to collect data, Weber said. Our staff provide an incredible support to the Nutrient Research Center at ISU, which relies on our researchers to analyze and assess. The state's nitrate data has shown an overall decline in stream pollution in recent years, but because of the drought, it is difficult to discern which way the situation is trending overall. Opinions about the trend vary. Helmers at the research center said, "It's hard to tell you year to year," adding that the so-called batch and build conservation program that was pioneered in the state in Polk County has led to a quicker adoption of edge-of-field practices. That idea to build bioreactors and buffers along multiple farms in a small region has been co-opted by state agriculture officials and is now one of the primary chosen weapons against stream contamination. We still need to scale up, Helmer said, get even more adoption of those practices. Don McDowell, communications director for the State Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship, said, "Iowans recognize that our variable weather will always introduce ups and downs as we move toward achieving our long-term nutrient reduction strategy goals." McDowell did not comment specifically on the department's views of the long-term trends, but said the state has broken records for conservation and water quality adoption in each of the last 2 years. The state's recent initiatives have more than doubled the dollars spent on conservation practices since the adoption in 2013 of the Nutrient Reduction Strategy, which prioritizes the voluntary efforts of farmers to curb their pollution. Its goal is to reduce the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus that leaves farm fields by 45%. McDowell noted that farmers are now planting cover crops for nearly 4 million acres of cropland, up from relatively none a decade ago. These crops are planted after harvest in fields that might otherwise be bare to control erosion and absorb nutrients that could go into streams. That acreage amounts to about 17% of the total that is planted with corn and soybeans each year. We know that these water quality practices work, and we are firmly committed toward accelerating the pace of their adoption, McDowell said. Farmers can be hesitant to change their practices because of the risks those changes pose. It might be a slower process than many would like, but from the perspective from the farmer, I'm jeopardizing my ability to stay in business if I made the bad decisions, Roger Zylstra, a Jasper County farmer, has said. That is the end of the article. We've now reached our midpoint of the reading. You're listening to Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Tuesday, March 5th, 2024, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Shelby from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. Again, please feel free to call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. Now, moving on to the obituaries. Our first obituary for today is for Nora Kephart. Nora A., known as Lonnie Kephart, age 47, of Glenwood, Iowa, passed away February 28th in 2024 at Jenny Edmondson Hospital in Council Bluffs. Lonnie was born May 16th in 1976 in Monroe, Louisiana, to Michael and Anne, whose maiden name was Keller Chambers. She graduated from Council Bluffs Abraham Lincoln High School in 1994. Lonnie married Randy Kephart on April 5th, 2002. She worked as an accountant for Conagra Foods for 5 years. Lonnie is survived by her husband of 21 years, Randy Kephart, son Nathan Lakin, daughters Amanda Kephart, Alexandra and Elizabeth Kephart, and Jordan Kephart, mother Ann Chambers, father Michael Chambers, brother Paul Chambers, and their sons Scott and Benjamin, sister Sarah Chambers, and many friends. Visitation for the family will be Wednesday from 6 to 8 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Funeral service will be Thursday at 11 a.m. at the funeral home. A lunch will immediately follow at the Walnut Hill Reception Center. The reception center's address is 1350 East Pierce Street. The family will direct memorial contributions. And the address for Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home and Crematory is 545 Willow Avenue in Council Bluffs, Iowa, zip code 51503. Our next obituary is for K.I. Lange. I'm unsure if I pronounced that last name right, so I will spell it. L-A-N-G-E. K.I. Lange, age 75, of Council Bluffs, affectionately known as Nana, passed away on March 3rd, 2024, at her residence. Kay was born in Council Bluffs on February 26, 1949, to the late Delmar L. and Mildred M., whose maiden name was Spark Carlson, and graduated from Tri-Center High School in 1967. Her working career began at Metropolitan Utilities District, known as MUD, and lasted for over 43 years, retiring as secretary to the president. Kay was a longtime and active member of the Neola Presbyterian Church, a 4-H leader, and enjoyed gardening and attending her 3 grandchildren's activities. She also worked with husband, Charles Lange, as they operated Reliable Maintenance Service. In addition to her parents, Kay is preceded in death by her husband, Charles E. Lange, on April 26, 2013. Survivors include her daughter, Michelle Botts, and husband, James of Neola, Iowa, 3 grandchildren, Emily Finken, and husband, Derek of Council Bluffs, Alyssa Botts, and fiancé Brody Barrier of Shelby, Iowa, and Tyler Botts of Neola, brother Randy Carlson, and wife Nancy of San Antonio, Texas, nephews Brad and Britt Carlson, her beloved dogs Opie, Tucker, and Briggs. Visitation will be Thursday from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home. The funeral service will be Friday, 11 a.m. at the Neola Presbyterian Church. Kay will be laid to rest with husband Charles in the Neola Township Cemetery, with a lunch on to follow back at the church. Addresses for the visitation is 545 Willow Avenue, Council Bluffs, Iowa, 51503, zip code. That is the Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home and Crematory. And then the funeral service will be the First Presbyterian Church of Neola, and the address is 400 on 2nd Street in Neola, Iowa, zip code 51559. Our next obituary is for Luann, maiden name Spence, McCartney, age 89, who died on February 28th in 2024 in Omaha, Nebraska. Luann was born on December 14th in 1934 in Council Bluffs. Following her graduation from Graceland College, she began her career as a teacher in Story City, Iowa, before devoting her life to raising a family and volunteering her spare time at the Midlands Hospital Auxiliary. In 1956, she married the late James McCartney, her best friend of nearly 70 years, and was the loving mother and grandmother of 5 children and 6 grandchildren. Luann is preceded in death by her brother, Ronald E. Spence, and survived by daughters Laura Long and Linda McGuire, sons John, Joel, and Jason McCartney, grandchildren Haley, Sam, Jacob, Joe, Kate, and James, brother Lauren Spence, sister-in-law Evelyn Spence, and many nieces, nephews, and cousins. The family plans to honor Luann with private services at a later date. In lieu of flowers, Luann's memory may be honored with a contribution to the Rocky Mountain Conservancy. Our next obituary is for John M. McClellan Sr. Family welcomes to join them Saturday, March 23rd, 2024, from 9:30 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. for coffee and donuts in the Dundee Presbyterian Church parlor prior to a 10:30 a.m. celebration service in the sanctuary. You can see more information on it at the website heafey.com. Our next article will be titled St. Albert's Underwood, Elsie's Larson, selected to IPSWA 1A 4A second team, Klusman makes third team, written by Peter Burnett from the Nonpareil. St. Albert's Ava Underwood and Lewis Central's Brooke Larson were both second-team All-State selections in 1A and 4A per an IPSWA release. The teams announced by the Iowa Print Sports Writers Association were selected during an in-person meeting by approximately 37 Iowa Print sports writers and basketball coaches during a meeting on Saturday, March 2nd. Solson's Callie Levin was selected at Miss Iowa Basketball. St. Albert's Underwood, a junior, averaged a double-double to lead the Saints to their first state tournament win since 2000. Over the season, she averaged 11.6 points, 7.6 rebounds, 2.8 assists, 1.4 steals, and 1.5 blocks per game when shooting 53.7% from the field. Senior Ella Klusman was selected to the 1A All-State third team, averaging 11.5 points, 2.5 rebounds, 1.5 assists, and 2.1 steals per game, shooting 37% from the field and 32.8% on third pointers. From Lewis Central, Brooke Larson, who is a junior, was selected to the 4A All-State second team. Larson averaged 15.6 points, 7.2 rebounds, 1.9 assists, 3.4 steals, and 0.6 blocks, with the shooting percentage from the field at 42.1% for the Titans, who reached the state tournament for the first time since 2020. Our next article will be titled Final Four Roll Cards. Traynor wins fifth straight state quarterfinal to advance to semifinals. Written by Peter Burnett. Final Four roll call, no roll cards. Fifth-seeded Traynor won their fifth straight state quarterfinal by answering a West Burlington push with a dominant fourth quarter and a 73-63 win Monday night. The last 5 times we went to state, we've been here in the Final Four. I'm an old coach, said 18-year, but still youthful Cardinals head coach Scott Rucker. I love having a week to prepare, and that's what I love about coaching. Rucker also loved the effort his team showed in the win and how the players and his staff executed the gameplay. We just felt good about our plan coming in, he said. What else are we going to do for a week? But it gets harder here now. We got 3 days, and we'll stay up tonight. But we tell our kids there's nothing like a state tournament, except for winning games at the state tournament. So they got to experience that, and I'm really happy. The Cardinals had about as lovely a start as they could have asked for, as Alec Lovely drilled a three-pointer to start the scoring. The Cardinals would start on an 8-0 run and expand their lead to 13-4 as they started 7-9 from the field and 3-4 on three-pointers. It's always good to get off to a good start, Rucker said. I think it's probably especially good in the state tournament, the first time for sure. The Falcons chipped away at the deficit, getting it as close as 2 by getting to the line and taking advantage. In the bonus, with 4:39 left in the first, the Falcons finished 7-8 on free throws, while the Cardinals were 1-6. But shooting 4-9 on three-pointers helped the Cardinals hold a 5-point lead at the first. After being in check in the opening 8 minutes, senior Jace Tams started heating up, making 3 straight field goals as the Cardinals went on a 7-2 spurt to increase their lead back to 8. The Falcons weren't done yet, however, twice cutting the deficit to just 1 point as leading scorer Mason Watkins tallied 13 first half points. Tams and Lovely combined for 21 points, shooting 9-14 from the field, as the Cardinals carried a 32-28 lead into the locker room at halftime. Treanor started the second half at the front foot, but momentum quickly turned to West Burlington. The Falcons made 3 straight shots to take their first lead of the game on a Kobe Davis pull-up jumper with 4:13 left in the third. The teams would go back and forth, and after a first half without 5 lead changes sent the pendulum swinging. West Burlington would ultimately grab the edge in the quarter, getting their lead to as many as 5 before Corbin Thien scored 5 to make a deficit 53-50 heading into the fourth. Early in the fourth, Carson Elwood took control, making a close basket and converting and one to tie the game at 55. I'm able to use my size in the game like that. We're not used to it when we're not as tall, but a lot of these plays are really set up by my teammates, Elwood said. Like when I was able to get that and one, it's perfect. When we have shooters like that on the outside, they're going to attract attention. So it's going to give me an opportunity for one-on-ones, and I just got to finish. All even with 6 minutes to play, Mason Watkins was fouled on a 3-point attempt, but made 2 of 3 free throws to put the Falcons up by 2. Alec Lovely then drilled a 3-pointer from the wing, creating an Elwood offensive rebound to put the Cardinals up 58-57 with 4:28 left. That's been our thing through the year. We've had many close games, and we just figured out that if we keep our cool, we can easily win the game, Lovely said. That was just our mindset. Keep our cool and see what happens. Lovely would finish with a co-game high, 22 points, tied with West Burlington's Mason Watkins, to go with 4 rebounds and 2 assists. The Cardinals would make it a 5-point lead after a pair of free throws from Lovely and a layup by Ethan Cons. Lovely and Rucker, the rebounding and help side defense, were the keys in the fourth quarter resurgence. I feel like in the third quarter, we didn't have a lot of help side. But on the fourth quarter, they really couldn't do a whole lot, Lovely said. Couldn't really do a whole lot roughly translates to 2-14 from the field, as Falcons were the first 6:50 of the fourth quarter without a made field goal. That lead would stretch to 7-9 before a pair of Corbin Thien free throws made it to 11 for the Cardinals' largest lead in the game. Thien would finish the game 8-9 from the line, scoring 12 points and pulling down 5 rebounds. I just rolled the basket, and I got easy dump downs, and they just fouled me a lot, Thien said. The refs were calling a lot, but we had to be mentally tough, and we knew they were going to get fouled out. After fouling out, Elwood found his place on the bench with 2:46 left. We had to be encouraging on the bench, Thien continued. And keep the mentality going throughout the bench the entire game. The Falcons made their first field goal of the final quarter on a 3 with 1 minute and 10 seconds left, but it was home and dry for the Cardinals. Five Cardinals, Lovely, Tams, Thien, Elwood, and Cons, finished in double figures. In spite of scoring just 3 points in the third quarter, Tams turned things around and had the support of his teammates around him. "At the end of the day, that's what's special about this team," Tams said. "They can try to take me away, and then Alec, Carson, Ethan, and Aaron, Corbin, and everyone else is going to do their thing." For Rucker, it's the first thing he can remember this season that he's had 5 players with at least 10 points each. "I think we've had 5 guys that are definitely capable. They haven't done it all on the same night, but I'm quite positive we haven't. But I think that each guy kind of played their role really well," Rucker said. By attacking the glass and pressuring the rim, the Cardinals answered the Falcons' flight and earned a hard-fought win. Tams was an example of that, overcoming what Rucker said the senior guard might call an off night, 6 out of 16 on field goals, by pulling down 9 rebounds for a near double-double. "He wasn't quite scoring like he normally does or shooting like he normally does, but he found the ways to impact the game still," Rucker said. Now, Traynor goes back to the 2A semifinals for the 5th straight time, where they'll match up with number 1 Western Christian, Hull, who has a record of 21 wins and 3 losses, at 10:30 a.m. on Thursday. The calling card? You guessed it. Toughness. "You know what I'm going to say. It's going to take some toughness, and that toughness will manifest itself in how we rebound the basketball," Rucker said. Our next article is titled, "Caitlin Clark Says It's Hard to Wrap Her Head Around Being Called NCAA's Division I Top Scorer," written by Eric Olson and Associated Press. Caitlin Clark broke 3 major college basketball scoring records in less than 3 weeks. "Finally, the Iowa superstar can take a breath. I'm so focused on helping this team win and be so great, it's hard to wrap my head around everything going on," she said. "I'm trying to soak in the moment." Clark's dizzying regular season ended Sunday with her passing Pete Maravich at the NCAA Division I overall scoring leader during the 6th-ranked Hawkeyes' 93-83 win over number 2 Ohio State in Iowa City. 4 days earlier, she took down Lynette Woodward's major college women's scoring record. And 2 weeks before that, she broke Kelsey Plum's Division I record. Maravich's 54-year-old record was considered the holy grail, and many observers will want to put an asterisk on Clark's accomplishments, because Maravich amassed his 3,667 points in 83 games over 3 seasons at LSU, and without having a 3-point line or shot clock. Clark, who scored 35 points against the Buckeyes and built her reputation on the 3-point shot, will go to the Big Ten tournament with 3,685 points in 130 games. "I hope it advances women's sports even more," Iowa coach Lisa Blatter said. "But to me, you don't have to break a man's record to be recognized. You don't have to be doing that. Breaking Lynette's record was significant. So to me, I admire Pistol Pete. But at the same time, I just don't want that to be the bar for women's athletics." Clark, who announced last week that she would enter for the 2024 WNBA draft, said she hoped she's not just remembered for setting records at Iowa. "I hope people remember me for the way I played with a smile on my face, my competitive fire," she said. "Sure, they can remember the wins, but also the fun me and my teammates had together." Attention on Clark has increased each season since she arrived at Iowa in 2020, and the spotlight has been especially bright since she led the Hawkeyes to the NCAA championship game last year. Her name, image, and likeness deals with Nike, Gatorade, and State Farm, among others, have made her one of the most viable athletes, college or pro, in the nation. Her pursuit of scoring records, combined with her glitzy playing style, have brought media attention in an amount that would overwhelm most 22-year-olds. "The biggest part of my maturity and growth has been being able to handle that balance, everything going on around me, and the noise around me," she said. "And obviously, it can be hard at times, but I would never change that for the world." The Hawkeyes are off to the Big Ten tournament, starts later this week. They're the number 2 seed, meaning they don't play until Friday's quarterfinals in Minneapolis. She'll go into the postseason chasing conference and national championships, not scoring records. Bet she will go into her final games at Iowa atop the NCAA's all-time scoring chart is something she has yet to fully grasp. "That's really crazy to think about," she said. "If you had told me that before my college career started, I would have laughed that in your face and been like, no, you're insane," she said. "I've always been able to score the ball. People don't understand how many players came before me and were able to score the ball at such a high rate and do it for teams that were really, really good." Our next article is titled "Jeff Bezos Dethrones Elon Musk to Become the Richest Person on Earth Again" by Ramesha Maroof. Jeff Bezos has reclaimed the title of the richest person on earth, surpassing Elon Musk, according to the Bloomberg Billionaires Index on Monday. The Amazon founder's net worth was $200 billion, while Elon Musk followed at $198 billion. Musk had lost about $31 billion over the past year, while Bezos has gained $23 billion, according to the index. Tesla shares has rumbled more than 7% on Monday. Musk has reclaimed the title of the world's richest person in May 2023, edging out LVMH CEO Bernard Arnault, who runs one of the world's biggest conglomerates and includes brands such as Louis Vuitton, Dior, and Celine. The three centibillionaires, Musk, Arnault, and Bezos, have been in competition with each other due to a boom in luxury goods sales that have helped drive up LVMH's stock price. Our next article is titled "Corbyn Launches Campaign to Challenge Dawson for Iowa Senate District 10 Seat" by Scott Stewart. Council Bluffs City Council member Steve Corbyn announced a campaign Tuesday for Iowa Senate District 10. Corbyn, a Democrat, is running for the seat currently held by Senator Dan Dawson, a Republican, who is seeking re-election this fall to represent most of Council Bluffs in Carter Lake. The people of Council Bluffs have seeing a lack of opportunity because Dan Dawson and the Iowa Street Republicans have failed to fulfill their promises, Corbyn said in a news release. Corbyn has served on the council since 2021 and is a 30-year member of the Council Bluffs Fire Department. He's a former journeyman electrician as well. "I'm running for Iowa Senate to bring common sense among Council Bluffs values back to Des Moines," Corbyn said. "I will bring opportunity back to Council Bluffs by advocating for a stronger public education system, ensuring everyone has an opportunity to live a livable wage, and protecting Iowans' freedoms to health care from government outreach. Council Bluffs is where I spent 30 years serving my neighbors as a firefighter and my wife, Chris, as an educator for its public school system," Gorman said. "We have dedicated our lives to serving the city's most vulnerable. I will continue that service in the state Senate to ensure every Iowan can make their own choices and live their own lives without undue interference or restrictions in lieu of what we have been given by Republicans in Des Moines." Dawson is serving his second term in the Iowa Senate, where he is the chair of the Influential Ways and Means Committee, which considers legislation related to tax policy and budgeting. He also serves in the Iowa Army National Guard and as a special agent investigating major crimes for the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. Dawson touted historic income tax relief for Iowa families and legislation to improve Lake Manawa among his accomplishments in launching his re-election bid last November. Well, that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Tuesday, March 5th in 2024. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Shelby from Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland and is used today around the world and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.